This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
Hello, Hearts of Oak. Thank you so much for joining us for another, not a live stream, a pre-record, and a guest that we have had on previously talking about censorship in Islam. I think it was a number of months ago. Claire Lopez, thank you for your time once again.
Well, thank you very much for having me back. I'm very glad to be with you.
Great to have you, and I do enjoy going through your Twitter. Just before I jump into that, can I just say to our the viewers, thank you if you're watching on, this will be a pre-record, so it'll be up on all of the platforms. We're now streaming onto Rumble as well, so that's about 8 different destinations we're streaming to, and we upload after onto BitChute and Gab, or you may be listening on any of our, on Podbean, or any of our podcasting platforms. We're up on Spotify, Amazon, Google, all of them from Podbean. So thank you for your feedback and input. Lots of emails. So do send us your emails, info@heartsofoak.org. Good to have your thoughts, your feedback, and any changes. We've just changed the intro and outro to a wonderful guest I had on before, was Bosch Fostin, and he's just done a great intro and outro. He's got a wonderful, warm voice, and it fits perfectly to our podcast. So that's Bosch doing an intro and outro to our podcasts. And Claire, if I can, I was just looking through your Twitter feed, which I will bring up, at Claire M. Lopez. You can find Claire's many comments, and I just, as a range of things, you were retweeting Ted Cruz was, "I am on the ground at Del Rio, Texas tonight. As of this moment, there are 10,500 legal aliens on the international bridge." That was Jadergo. Then you'd retweeted the Federalist, "Trump defense secretary says Miley went rogue, had no authority to pass secret intel to communist China." Then you put up on the 12th September, "But it was the Iranian regime that conceived, directed, executed the 9/11 attacks," and we'll probably get into that. You'd put out the Daily Wire, "Former Director of National Intelligence Joe Biden is greatest national security threat we face." And on COVID, you'd retweeted Martin Kulldorff, whom I'm a great fan of, "For informed public health policy, it is urgent that the CDC quickly do a national random test to estimate the prevalence of COVID antibodies and T-cell immunity." All fascinating, but we'll steer clear of that. But I would encourage you to go and look at Claire's Twitter feed, and it is wonderful. I think Claire and Jack Posobiec are the two that I enjoy most going through on the Twitter feed. So do go.
I'm in good company. Thank you.
No, do go and enjoy that. And on Claire's Twitter feed, it says, "Lopez Liberty LLC, American patriot, MAGA, defender of the U.S. Constitution, Western civilization, and the right of people everywhere to live free," which is quickly disappearing. But so many topics, but we're going to look and focus on the Middle East, Afghanistan, and the title is "Will Past Be Prologue?" And it is the end of America's 20-year involvement in Afghanistan, just the opening chapter of something else, possibly much worse. That was in my thoughts when we discussed this, Claire. But can I ask you about, can you just give us your thoughts looking at Afghanistan? I mean, the revelation came out that Biden had been discussing with the president of Afghanistan and had encouraged him to keep quiet on the advancement of the Taliban, which sheds a whole new light on what's happened there. But can you just give us maybe your thoughts on Afghanistan and what's just happened as a U.S. citizen?
Sure. So I think anybody who is a serious analyst of Afghanistan has realized for a very long time that the United States and NATO, too, would be pulling out of Afghanistan at some point, and that the country would revert under control of the Taliban once again. Perhaps the fact that the final collapse came with such rapidity in August of this year, 2021, around a month ago, maybe that was not completely expected. Should have been, I think, for all the money we all spend on intelligence. But be that as it may, it did collapse. And the Taliban now rule Afghanistan once again, not all of it. Yes, there are still pockets of resistance. I think there are still some fighting in the Panjshir Valley, perhaps others. Afghanistan being a tribal society, not really a country, honestly, as we think of countries. I mean, yes, you know, Britain at one point in time was warring Anglos and Saxons and Celts and all of that, but it has come together hundreds of years now since to become a unified nation. But Afghanistan never did. It is still a patchwork of warring warlords, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Hazara, the Pashtun, which is where the Taliban comes from. And I think I expect to see those ethnic groups going after each other again. In the 1990s, as we'll recall, in the aftermath of the end of the Afghan war against the Soviet Red Army, which was defeated and left the country at the end of the 1980s, the warlords, some of the very same names that we're seeing now again, the Haqqanis, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, of course, others of the Taliban, and allied with Al-Qaeda, which likewise in the 1990s was just coalescing. People forget that neither Al-Qaeda nor the Taliban existed in Afghanistan during the 1980s war. They did not come together or coalesce until the 1990s. Now today, I think we are going to see, I mean, I have titled some of my talks, Is Past Prologue, or Will Past Be Prologue? And I ask that question because we're seeing some of the very same actors come together once again in power in Afghanistan. And by that, I mean Iran, whose role is not completely clear. Hezbollah, of course, which is under the command and control of Iran, but which has been training the Taliban in Afghanistan since the 1990s. Of course, Al-Qaeda, with which the Taliban never did break ties. And then all of these, various and sundry warlords who sometimes squabble and fight among themselves, as I said, like the Haqqanis, for example. But you know, when push comes to shove, unite against the infidel, that's us. And then with the addition now of the Islamic State, which wasn't around in the 1990s, and subtracting Saudi Arabia, which very much was part of the mix in the 1990s and certainly up to its eyeballs in the attacks of 9/11 against the United States. But now, no. Under new leadership of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia is taking a different path. And I don't mean to suggest that this is out of the goodness of their blackguard little hearts. It's not. It is out of self-interest and preservation of the royal family, but they see their interest in countering the threat from Iran by working with Israel, which they understand perfectly well is not going to harm them or attack them. And so minus Saudi Arabia, plus IS, but the others, the same actors coming together again as in the 1990s. And this is what concerns me, because I don't see our senior leadership here in the United States, meaning our Secretary of State Blinken, Secretary of Defense Austin, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, or spokespeople out of the White House. Or for that matter, I would have to say leadership of NATO countries. I don't see statements of concern coming from folks like these about what I've just told you. It seems very evident to me. I cannot imagine that it's not evident to them what's happening and the threat that at least could be developing, but I don't hear anyone addressing it. And so that's my concern.
Well, on just before we talk about the wider issue, you mentioned how the U.S. figures and authority, how they view this. And I've seen many questions with to many officials from Department of Defense or Foreign Office. And I'm wondering, do they not get the utter disaster that this is on the U.S., on the, I mean, what? Yeah, do you understand that? Or is this just, you're just taking pot shots at the left? And do they understand the situation?
Right, so I think we have to understand one thing, and perhaps this is not as clear across the pond, as we say, as it may seem to some of us here. And that is that this current administration of Joe Biden, who, of course, was vice president to two terms of President Obama a number of years ago. This administration includes many of the very same people in appointed positions of senior leadership as were in the Obama administration. So think of it almost as, you know, the third term of the Obama administration in a way. And of course, President Obama never left Washington, D.C., as every other president in America before him has done after their administrations. Mm. He remains. Many believe that he has a strong voice position inside of directing whatever is going on with the Biden administration. But here's to say, both of these administrations and the people that I'm talking about, they come to leadership in America, unfortunately, with a worldview, a Weltanschauung, that says America is a force for ill in the world. And they therefore, in some way, see their task as bringing America down. They think that's what they should be doing. Bring America down, globalize us so that we're nothing more than another country out of 194 in the world on the globalist scene, that we are not leaders of the free world. They don't believe in any of that. I don't know if that's clear to maybe all of your audience today, but take it to heart. This is how they think.
Because it was under Obama, wasn't it? There was a huge surge of U.S. troops going into Afghanistan.
There was a surge, and it was intended to block further advances by the Taliban at the time. But here's the thing. The United States leadership, including our top military leadership, I will take nothing away from the honor that is due every single American and NATO service member who fought there, especially those who didn't come home or came home grievously injured, maybe sometimes for life. This is not to diminish any of the honor that belongs to those courageous people. But our leadership at the top levels of the U.S. military and the U.S. government, they never, ever addressed exactly the enemy. The enemy in Afghanistan is not terrorism any more than the enemy in World War II, where my father and my uncle fought, was blitzkriegism. It's ridiculous, right? They never named Islamic Jihad. The Taliban perceives itself as the vanguard of Islam. Remember what Taliban means. The word Talib, singular, is student. Taliban, plural, is students, plural. And originally, as formed by the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, which still backs, arms, funds, and trains them to this day and gives them safe haven, they were drawn out of the madrasas, the Islamic schools on both sides of the border among Pashtun tribal areas, Pakistan and Afghanistan, to bring order. Remember how I said that things in Afghanistan fell into complete disarray, chaos After the Afghan War of the 80s and the warlords were all fighting each other, the Afghan people took the brunt of it. The cities were being bombarded, etc. Casualties were horrible. That is why the Taliban was formed. But remember what the name means. They are students. The students who come out of those schools, madrasas, study nothing of biology or mathematics or anything else useful to modern life. They study only the Quran. Only the Quran. That is where they came from, and to this day, many still come from. So they see themselves as the vanguard of the global Islamic movement. They defeated the Soviets. Now they've defeated America and NATO, the West. They think they're on a roll, and I do too. But the role is about Islam, and we have to say that. If you listen to their statements, and many of them are translated for English-speaking audiences and others, this is what they say. They are seeking to expand the rule of Islamic law, of Sharia. Of course, unfortunately, the constitution that our American State Department wrote for the Afghan people under the leadership of Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, Noah Feldman, and others at the Department of State in 2004 already put Afghanistan under Islamic law. Don't know how many people have read the Afghan constitution, but it's in English online. And the first three articles are all you really need to read. Afghanistan shall be an Islamic republic. Right. Every law shall be according to Sharia, and no law shall be promulgated that is in contradiction of Sharia. Period. You don't need any more. This is what they fight for, and we need to understand that, but I think our senior leadership does not.
Well, I want to go down to look more on the Islam, but can I just touch again just a little bit more on the geopolitical side before? I want to just bring up a map because or I don't know how our viewers will really get Middle East geography. It's interesting that, and I've looked at a number of maps, and Afghanistan, Pakistan are kind of off to the side, on the edge, and they're the problem countries. And then you've got the rest of Saudi Arabia, or the rest of the Middle East, probably with the exception of Iran, which are regarded as probably more friendly to the West. Possibly that's because of the natural resources they provide. But I'm wondering that with America now pulled out, whose problem now is Afghanistan? Is it Pakistan, or will they actually come together and align? Is the problem more into Saudi Arabia? So, I mean, yeah, whose problem now is Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's the entire Western world, our problem collectively, because as I said, the Taliban now control at least most of Afghanistan. But just as in the 1990s, that's not going to stay in Afghanistan. They will come for us. I don't know that they will come back to do a big attack in our homeland or any of yours, or if they will choose to attack military bases of NATO member countries or diplomatic facilities. Don't know. But rest assured, they will come for us. They are not going to stay in Afghanistan. It's their mandate. Verse 839 of the Quran says, and fight them until there is no more tumult, no more division, and all be for Allah alone. Now, they think those are the literal revealed words of Allah, and they think if they don't obey that, they're going to hell. That's what they think. So they will not stay in Afghanistan. Whose problem is it? Well, I think it's the West's, because we are their target. And by the West, I mean we of NATO countries, certainly, the United States. And I also think probably newly developing, shall we say, partners in the Middle East. For example, Saudi Arabia, I mentioned before, taking a different path now, working behind the scenes to support the Abraham Accords with Israel, in close consultations with Israel now for a long time. They will come for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and those who ally with them. I think they can all be expected to be targets. And of course, we and I believe the United Kingdom as well have all kinds of diplomatic and military bases in that region, in and around the Persian Gulf, let's say. The role of Iran as yet to me is not completely clear. Of course, Iran was behind the attacks of 9/11, directed and organized it all. I'm not completely sure yet what its relationship will be with the new Taliban rulers in Kabul. I think that Russia will be very wary. And I can see Russia working with border countries around Afghanistan, like, let's say, Tajikistan, to block, if they can, any outward expansion, aggression by the Taliban. China, a player now that was not so in the 1990s, has already, of course, expressed support for the Taliban. I think despite denials, they've got their eye on Bagram Air Force Base. We'll see. That we, the Americans, abandoned for no reason, along with over $80 billion, with a B, dollars worth of top-of-the-line advanced U.S. military equipment. But I know that China also has its eye on natural resources in Afghanistan, in particular rare earth elements like lithium. I don't know if that will come, agreements on things like that will come to fruition right away. And I think that China's economy is not quite going all gangbusters, as some may think. I think that it is slowing. It is even stalling. And in particular, we can see this with regard to Pakistan, another one of the border countries around Afghanistan. I already mentioned the ISI, having founded the Taliban, still works closely with it, provides safe haven and so forth. Back to China and Pakistan, you know, China's big initiative is the Belt and Road Initiative. They just entered into an agreement with Iran. I guess it was last year, I think, something like, you know, billions of dollars over a period of 25 years to extend the Belt and Road Initiative westward all the way to the Persian Gulf. And in return, I guess Iran is going to provide China with oil, which it does not have much in the way of resources. That's the deal. But likewise, in Pakistan, there are all sorts of deals projected. And the key sort of link of the Belt and Road Initiative is called the CPEC, China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, that runs through Pakistan and out to the sea. That outlet to the sea is very important. And the port of Gwadar, which they're building, the Chinese are building. But some of those projects are now lagging in financing, in terms of completion, of meeting deadlines, illustrative of what I'm saying about the Chinese economy. So just keep an eye on that, that their economy is really not doing all that great in terms of ambitions, whether Afghanistan or the region. But those are sort of the neighbors, I guess, around Afghanistan.
Because when I read what you said about China changes my perception a little bit, because when I had read about the possibility of Afghanistan sitting on what, 1 trillion of lithium specifically, and lithium, of course, is the one of the main products in batteries. And when you look at, I think I read that every Tesla car has 60 kilograms of lithium for the battery. Huge. So obviously, if it has so much, then that could completely unbalanced, because the moment you think Saudi is the stable country, and if Afghanistan have that connection with China and suddenly have a huge market for their lithium and other rare earth minerals, then that changes immediately the whole dynamics of stability in the Middle East.
It certainly could. Again, I'm not sure that the mining rights that we're talking about are going to materialize immediately. It could be down the road a ways. I think more immediate concerns have to do with where is all of that U.S. equipment going?
Yeah.
and for what price? Will it be reverse engineered? Things like that. And then, of course, as I mentioned, Bagram Air Force Base, that's a key piece of real estate inside of Afghanistan, close to the Chinese border. I think those things are priority, but we'll see about the rest. But I think the Chinese are pretty savvy. They're not going to get themselves bogged down inside of Afghanistan with some kind of massive presence like Russia or the U.S. and NATO have done. They're not going to do that. They're going to milk it for whatever they can get out of it and for the least amount of return.
And you mentioned about the weaponry, and the Taliban are now one of the best armed, certainly terrorist organizations, but it is one of the best armed countries in the world. And I wonder, after actually defeating America, and that's how they will put it, and that's maybe how it does even look to the world, even though Biden did say they were going to withdraw, it seemed they withdrew, being kicked out. I'm wondering whether the Taliban then think, actually, why stop? We could carry on, or has their goal always been oppose America, and in fact they've won that, and therefore they can consolidate and grow the country as opposed to expanding.
Well, yes, they are going to face internal divisions and very likely civil war. Yes, they will have to deal with that. And no, I can't. I mean, looking at that map you had up there. And the countries on the periphery of Afghanistan, which is off to the right of the map there in gray, I don't see the Taliban actually invading any of those places. And here's a little, I don't know, silver lining to the cloud, maybe. That is, they're not going to be able to maintain this equipment. If they can even read the manuals to start with, but secondly of all, the mechanical, the technological expertise is a very highly advanced, pieces of equipment. At some point, I think a lot of it very likely will break down, and they won't be able to get the parts for it either, very likely. So, keep your eye on that. But again, I don't think their plan is to actually physically invade anyone on their periphery, but rather like 9/11, or on a lesser scale, perhaps, use Afghanistan as a base of operations to launch attacks in various places. And again, your UK, our US, NATO partners, bases, diplomatic facilities around the Middle East, certainly, perhaps even more widely.
Earlier on, you talked about Islam and its role, and it seems as though that's one of the unifying themes in the country. You talked about all the ethnic divides, it's tribal, and yet Islam is the one thing that unites, and a form of Islam which the West are afraid about. And when the West talk about reform, that's the wrong reform. They weren't thinking of that. But actually, when you look at what's happening, the Taliban's view of Islam is back to the original, is going back to the original teachings of the beginning. So it is a pure Islam or a real Islam or a literalist Islam. What does that mean for, again, stability in the region with other countries who have different interpretations, different sects within Islam? And suddenly you've got a completely pure, completely literalist form of Islam. So how does that impact its neighbors and the surrounding nations?
Yeah, I mean, again, we were looking at that map. I will say this, there is only one Islam. There aren't varieties, there aren't versions, there's one Islam. It is the Islam of Quran and Sunnah and Sharia, period. Now, the Taliban, as you say, are pure. They are the most devout, faithful, and practicing of all Muslims, maybe with the exception of the Islamic State. You're pretty much up on a par with them. But even as we see some of these other neighboring countries, which are Islamic, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and others maybe a little further to the east, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, it's not that they have a different version of Islam. It is the extent to which they choose to enforce it.
Yeah.
They have the exact same Islam.
Yeah.
It's a question of enforcement. And many of these other places have decided that it's in there and their people's best interest to enforce to a lesser extent than the Taliban does. That's the difference. So, you know, I don't see them you know, going along with or supporting or wanting to be any part of the Taliban's mission of Islamic Jihad. They're not going to be part of that. And there will be opposition, certainly among Abraham Accord countries, which are four at the moment, UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco, with, of course, Saudi Arabia very firmly behind them, behind the scenes, Israel. And likely others within the Middle East or Persian Gulf region, they're not going to want any part of this. And they value the relationship with Britain, with NATO countries, with the United States. We who have diplomatic presence and military bases in their countries, they want to continue those relationships, deepen those relationships. So I can expect, I mean, I would look to see a real split among, you know, some of these countries. I would love to be a fly on the wall, for example, inside of a meeting of the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is the 50-member state, I should say 50-member government organization of all Islamic governments in the world, 56 countries plus the Palestinian Authority government. Would love to be a fly in the wall as all of these countries sit around the table or however they do it and discuss the direction they're going to go. I can see the throwing of shoes. I mean, that's my imagination, but that's what comes to mind.
I'm also in the UK, we have, I think the last report was about 12 years ago from one of our think tanks, and it's came up with a figure of, I think it was 67% or might have been 70% of our imams were Deobandi school from India and possibly Pakistan. So again, a very literalist form of Islam, and it caused much concern in the UK. And I'm wondering whether from Afghanistan, we will see the export of, again, that I agree with you completely. There is only one Islam completely. But you still have that competing element within the Middle East of who has, I mean, Saudi Arabia claims that it is the bastion of true Islam, probably simply because it has Mecca and Medina there. And I'm wondering whether something much worse will spring out from Afghanistan, where they may start having madrasas and people going for those and people really being trained up, and a whole spreading of that across, which is disastrous to all of us.
Well, I think the answer to your question there goes back to where the Deobandi school comes from. The Deobandi school of Islam arose in the Indian city of Deoband, and it was led by Maulana Maududi, who was a student and an acolyte of Sayyid Qutb, one of the leading theoreticians, ideologues of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's how that connection came to be. But it spread outwards from Deoband, India, throughout the subcontinent, just as you say. And of course, the Pakistanis took it up with gusto. And of course, out of the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, were created. I mean, the Taliban itself and other groups like Lashkar-e-Toiba, Lashkar-e-Jangvi, and others. These are all of the Deoband school of Islamic Jihad. Same Islam, very much aligned with the thinking of the Muslim Brotherhood leaders of that time, Sayyid Qutb, Hassan al-Banna. But as you say, they are purists. They are pure Islam. And they seek to impose it and spread it. I think India is going to be a primary target. Of course, we all remember what happened in Mumbai in 2008. Yeah. Those attacks were directed, as we know now, by the Pakistani ISI. I would expect that India will be a target again. I very much hope that our respective countries' Western ties with India. The United States has a strong relationship with India and with its Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. India is part of what we call the Quad, which includes India, Australia, Japan, and the United States. Now, the Quad is perhaps more aligned to defend against China aggression. But nevertheless, that is a strong relationship, and there are others. So I think it's going to be very important for us of the West, Britain, NATO countries, United States, to stand absolutely strong with India, because they will become a primary target. And yes, this is out of the Deoband school.
You mentioned some of the other groups. You mentioned IS, Al-Qaeda, other groups, and they have, I guess, attempted to spread Islam through jihad through force, where other countries have used, I guess, with India and Pakistan, they've used their madrasas, their training schools, to actually train imams and send them around. And they've looked at it as I guess, an element of missionary work, where other groups have decided to use a different method to expand the religion of Islam, and that's been by force. So how do those groups, IS and Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, how do they kind of fit together?
Well, think of this as a division of labor, a splinter movement theory, you might call it. All the splinters are aimed at the same final objective, 839, till all be for Allah, right? But they go about it and they come at it from different directions. And so just as you say, some of the vanguard jihad organizations, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Boko Haram, Taliban, Islamic State, more, they are the tip of the spear in terms of violent jihad attacks all over against everybody, worldwide. But then there is an organization worldwide like the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, which is present in at least 80, probably a lot more countries of the world. And its mission is to spread Islam through information operations, through front groups here in America, of course. We have CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, which actually is the U.S. branch of Hamas, but also other groups like MPAC, Muslim Public Affairs Council, the Muslim American Society, ISNA, Islamic Society of North America, so many more, many of which, by the way, here in the United States are grouped under political umbrella group called the USCMO, United States Council of Muslim Organizations, a group of Muslim Brotherhood groups. And by the way, you know who the sponsor is of the Muslim Brotherhood in America? It definitely used to be Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
But it's not anymore. That baton has been passed to Turkey. It is Turkey that now has that lead in terms of the vanguard of the Muslim Brotherhood, support for it. They are doing the mosque building. They're doing the funding of, let's say, imams, publications. The Turks are the ones present at all the Muslim Brotherhood conventions and conferences here in the United States. I can't speak entirely to Europe, but I can certainly say that is the case here in the United States. The Saudis are gone. They're nowhere to be seen. But the Turks are all over the place. So that's another splinter, right? The information operation, the front group operations of Islam. And then you've got the international level organizations that operate at the diplomatic level, you might say. And that would include organizations like the OIC, which actually has NGO, I think it is, observer status at the United Nations, right? So you've got each of these different avenues, and then you have nation states, which are members of the OIC, like Iran, like Pakistan, which very openly sponsor, fund, train, arm the violent jihad groups. So again, a division of labor, but it's all aimed at the same goal, 839.
My last thought was on the immigration from Afghanistan. Here in the UK, we've talked about taking 20,000 Afghanis over a number of years. We've talked about taking the women and children and doctors and nurses. I don't know why doctors and nurses' lives are more important than someone else, but anyway, we've decided that. But then, of course, well, do you not bring all the men over? Do you not bring the families? So the reckoning is we're looking at maybe 60,000. And in the US, you've talked about, the Democrats have talked about taking crazy amounts. And I saw you tweeted or retweeted, I think it was an article by Pamela Geller, looking at Afghan men coming into the US with their child brides. And it made me think that it is madness to think that you've run away from a country because it's too difficult, it's too messed up, it's impossible to control and manage. But then you want to bring a lot of those people to your country and the impact that will have on the fabric of our societies in the West is simply destructive. Is that conversation happening in America where people saying, whoa, we have to think of this and see whether it's conducive to the common good of the states to bring over people from a society that think one thing that doesn't fit into what we believe?
Yes, those conversations are happening all over America, but unfortunately not at our leadership level, White House, Department of State, and so forth. And this is a very serious issue. Number one, we, unfortunately, Americans can be said to be participating in child trafficking. That's what that is. That's child trafficking, sexual abuse. I mean, any men, older men that come in with three and four little girl brides, 12 and 13 years old, the men should be given two choices. Choose deportation immediately or go to jail.
Yeah.
And the little girls belong in protective custody.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that. And the second, maybe the bigger overall issue, is that we don't know how to vet these people. Because we've all become so politically correct over here, it is not permissible for our consular officers or our customs and border protection officers to question intending immigrants or refugees or evacuees, any of the above categories, to question them and say, are you ready to accept allegiance, to pledge allegiance to a Judeo-Christian-based constitution, because that's what we have in America, and forsake allegiance to any and all other legal systems, including Islamic law, Sharia, or are you not? Nobody will ask those questions. So we get child trafficking, we get sex slavery, and I feel very bad for the little girls, of course. But as you say also, we are diluting our own society with people who hate us and who don't believe in pledging allegiance to our Judeo-Christian-based constitution.
Well, we are having exactly the same problem in the UK with, we've just seen our immigration levels. This is an example of what we face in the UK. In 2018, we had about 400 people came over in boats from Europe. In 2019, it was up to 3,000. In 2020, it was up to 8,000. And so far this year, it's up to 13,000. And again, people come with no passports, no ID, young girls, young children. And we think it's wonderful to accept them all instead of questioning why that is happening and trying to put an end to that level of people trafficking. So it is a problem certainly we face, and you're obviously facing as well, with the Afghan situation. I was going to, I'll not ask any deeper on the US side, because you'd have to look deep into Joe Biden's soul, and that's a dark place. So we'll not go there. I think we'll, Claire, thank you so much for your time. It's a fascinating subject, and we've obviously sat and watched it, our viewers on the sidelines, and you're someone who really understands this. So thank you for coming on, explaining the situation a little bit more, and the geopolitics and that pure form of Islam, which I think is a concern to us all and a major threat. So thank you so much for coming on. And can I leave our view once again at Claire M. Lopez? Go, that's Claire's Twitter feed. Go and have a look at that. And our programs, you know, Hearts of Oak, where every Monday and Thursday is a guest video, and every Saturday is our news review. And we're also putting out on Wednesdays short info videos on a range of topics we think you'll find interesting. And if you do want to know where to find and don't know which platform we're on next, just go to heartsofoak.org/find. us, and you can see the list of everything available. So on that, I will, I think, say goodbye to our viewers. Thank you for joining, whether you've been watching on the platforms or listening. Great to have you with us. And if you haven't subscribed yet, do go to heartsofoak.org and click on that connect tab, and you can get our weekly email. Comes out usually Monday, so do that. And Claire, just thank you once again for coming on and sharing your insight into this issue.
Well, and thank you for having me, and a very good, wide-ranging discussion. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much, and goodbye to all our viewers.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list, donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.